Well, it depends on how you define pretrial services. I know that you had a presentation from McLean County where they really have employees doing a lot of background information, but those people aren't going to court for a while. We have people going to court and getting arraigned a lot faster than them. So I'm not really sure how you're defining pretrial. Having somebody have the ability to, you know, corroborate employment and medical issues and stuff would be helpful. I think it would be more helpful to have it in my office than with the court or the state's attorney's office, since we're the advocate for them and there may be confidentiality issues, HIPAA issues, and things like that.
And if I could also, I would throw the sheriff into that mix as well. Yeah. Oftentimes, I get and Randy gets emails from the sheriff saying he's got somebody in the jail who has medical issues. Or he's looking at the list himself and saying, what about this person? What about that person? Can you look at this case? Can you look at that case? Now, he's looking at the medical issues both from, that person's perspective as well as the county's perspective, because if someone's in custody and has medical issues, then we have to pay for it. And so he doesn't have that in his budget either, but he's part of the process as well.
Yeah. Just to tell you how little the public defenders has, our influence. I mean, in arraignment court, we may say to the judge, my clients ain't half much pregnant, but the judge may still set bond because their record's bad and stuff. And then when she's about to give birth, the sheriff, gets involved and then, things get done. But the judges have to make the decision based on the information they have. And sometimes medical problems get worse over time and the sheriff gets involved and we all work together to try and deal with those issues. Yeah.
We have not had any babies born in the jail, by the way.
Just now.
I think the only thing that surprised me about what you said, about 5 minutes to make a contact with a person before arraignment, which would, this is, if I understand the process, this is the bail or release on one's own recognizance would be considered. And so there's some obvious factors that are sort of routine, probably a fair amount of it is boilerplate. I understand.
Yeah.
But what I'm wondering is whether or not, I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this question.
Yeah.
Do you think that there are people who end up having a bond set that they can't meet because they don't have the money, who would in fact be just fine released on their own recognizance, but you haven't had enough time to put together a good case to argue for it? And if so, is that a little problem or a big problem?
I think it's possible. I don't think it's a huge problem. A lot of the timing is logistics. I mean, if there are only 8 people in custody, we're going to have far more than 5 minutes to talk with them. But, the state's attorney's office gets reports up until I'm not sure what time, 8 in the morning, 9 in the morning. They're reviewing stuff. So the jail's not even sure who's going to be going to court until 9, maybe 9:30. We get out there about 9:30 or 10. And then the jail has shift change and meals and the trays, and so the inmates can't be in there. So there's a window of maybe an hour and a half when we can go and see the people. And we oftentimes spend more than 5 minutes with them, but sometimes we don't.
I think, quite honestly, if we slowed the entire process down, we'd all have a lot more time to spend on each individual case, but then we'd slow the entire process down. And that, so yes, we're getting reports of things that happened up until the morning and then having to turn around and make decisions on them, whereas if we stuck to that statutory 48 hours before bond is set, then we'd all have a lot more time to spend on things, but then we'd have people sitting in custody. And I want to point out, too, Randy's office gets involved at arraignment at that initial hearing and speaks to the people in custody. In the vast majority of counties, there is nobody involved, and Scott can confirm. In McLean County, there's no public defender appointed at arraignment court and when bond is set. The person's on their own, unless they have a private attorney. There's nobody there standing up making an argument for them.
And we'll actually make arguments for everybody in custody. So if someone goes in front of the judge and says, I'd like a week to hire my own lawyer, we're not appointed, but we will still stand up and make a bond argument for them. The judge appoints us temporarily for that purpose.
Bill.
Randy, if you've got the answer to that question.
Well, I mean,
fundamentally, that's one of the fundamental issues that we got to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ask it lightheartedly.
No.
Well, how do we design and develop a society, a county, in which fewer people are getting arrested?
Now, part of it is education. For example, we have a lot of people who are arrested for traffic violations because their taillights are out and the police have the right to stop them, and then they find out they don't really have a license, you know. So if people were educated to fix their cars, if they were educated to be polite with the police and you know, maybe they would just get a ticket instead of resisting arrest kind of thing. I think if people, again, it's education. A lot of crimes are based on people who have addictions or mental health issues, and certainly it would be hard to educate, you know, everybody. But if you have a drug problem, get help for it. And I don't know. It's the chicken and the egg. I mean, you're asking a question that I don't think anybody else can really answer. There are so many different reasons why people get into the criminal justice system. And all you can do is kind of attack one little issue and another little issue, and I don't know if ultimately it would help that much. I don't know. I think that, you know, a lot of people who go off to prison, a lot of people who go off to prison, when they get out of prison, they reoffend. And we can't help those people. It's whatever prison's doing. But I think research has shown that, you know, if you give people opportunities at probation and give them the services they need, you know, substance abuse, mental health, whatever, they're less likely to reoffend. But some people, you know, can't afford the services. We get a lot of people who are on probation. They don't go to Community Elements. They don't go to Prairie Center because they don't have the money. And then they figure, well, if I can't afford, I'm just not going to go. And that's the worst thing that could ever happen, you know. I don't know. It's hard to answer.
Vanita.
Totally different community. So, right, we do need programs.
I'm not familiar with the summit, but I mean you're putting into my head some kind of an image of some kind of county program where you have people from disability and people from Social Security and you have people from all these different agencies, like a forum where you can actually give them assistance, like, oh, you need to sign up for Social Security here, you need to register to vote here, so people could all come together and get assistance to like do the things they need to do, because if they don't get the money, and it is a lot of the money issues, they may not have as much trouble in the criminal justice system. So it's a good idea. Well, let me answer that last part. There are so many fees, I couldn't even name what they go for. I mean, the General Assembly sets up fees for lots of different things, and many of them have specific purposes. You know, a court automation fee for the computers, or it goes to Crime Stoppers and things like that. There are a number of fees that go into specific funds for specific purposes. I can't talk to you about all the different ones. I think Julia may know more, and Deb Busey may even know more than that. But I know that for public defenders, there's a statute that says a judge can order someone to reimburse the county for the services of the public defender. It doesn't go to the individual attorney. It doesn't even come into my office's budget. It goes into the general corp. And then, hopefully some of it comes back to my office. We bring in $100,000, $120,000, something like that a year for the PD fee. I can't really speak about all the other fees where they go.
And that's generally $300.
In many felony, in some felony cases, it's usually $150 to $300. On misdemeanors, it can be, $75 to $200. They have to take into account the ability to pay, so.
Any other questions for Randy?
No.
Okay. Thank you much for coming.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Let's move on to Joe. He's been waiting patiently.
Thank you very much. My name is Joe Gordon. I'm the director of the Champaign County Probation and Court Services Department. Very briefly, within our department, we have three divisions. We have the juvenile division, the adult division, and we also operate the juvenile detention center. I'll concentrate specifically on what occurs on the adult side since that's what is of interest tonight. We have 13 officers assigned to the adult division of our department. And last month, in reviewing the statistics, we had 1,612 individuals under court order just for probation. That does not include those under court order for court supervision or conditional discharge. It's a whole different group of individuals. We don't actively monitor those individuals. We only monitor the probation cases. Our role in the system is to complete pre-sentence investigations for the court when ordered to do so and offer suggestions or possible conditions to the court and to the other parties as to possible alternatives for the individuals involved. In other words, if they are sentenced to a community-based sentence, what services might best address their needs? Once they are sentenced to probation, they'll appear in our office for initial interview. And during that interview, we will assess the case for the level of supervision. The state of Illinois, through the Administrative Office of the Illinois Courts, is utilizing an assessment instrument called the LSIR. We use it, and everybody in the state uses this instrument. And according to the level of scoring on that instrument is essentially the level of supervision that the individual will be provided. Typically, we'll have about 7 or 8% of that 1,600 individuals that will fall into the maximum care category. And we'll have a very small group of individuals that fall into the minimum category. The bulk of the cases, therefore, will fall into that medium category. You might see 1,000 cases. And those are the cases that we really do concentrate on, to be quite honest with you. We believe that we can make the most change, and statistics would reflect that to be the case, that you would concentrate your efforts on those individuals that are more agreeable to change. At this initial interview, not only with the assessment, but we will also make referrals for appropriate agencies. In other words, through that assessment process, we'll get some sense as to what services might best address their needs. Perhaps it would be, you know, mental health needs, or perhaps it would be substance abuse, or if it's a domestic case, then we will refer them for a partner abuse intervention program, something to that effect. But all the cases are assessed individually. The case will then be assigned to an officer following this assessment. We only have 4 officers that do the bulk of the assessments. We believe that that's the best way to get true results, having fewer number of individuals doing the assessments. There then, once the case is then assigned to an officer, and that officer might have 175 cases on their caseload. That would include maximum, medium, and minimum cases. And during the term of this probation, their responsibility is to make sure that they comply with the orders of the court. That would include reporting. That would include completing public service work, going to the social service agencies, obtaining and maintaining employment. We would monitor those conditions. Should an individual not be in compliance, we would sanction them, and that's what Lynn was referring to. We would call them into the office. We would have them come in. We would tell them, you know, you missed your appointment, or you need to prove that you're attempting to find a job. And then we will sanction them to get them back on track, and that's our role. This is referred to as a technical violation of probation. It's not a criminal act. It's just a violation of the court orders, which they could be subject to returning to court, but we will sanction them. That gets back to some discussion before about discretion. We do have a certain amount of discretion. And working closely with Julia's office, she allows us to do that. Once they get back on track, there are these other conditions that they'll have to comply with. We've talked about the money issue. They'll have to make their regular payments. They'll have to go to these social service agencies. They'll have to move toward completing the conditions. If they complete the conditions within the period of time, then their case will be closed on a satisfactory basis. If their case is not completed during that period of time satisfactorily, perhaps they don't come in line following the sanctions, then we will request through the state's attorney's office that the case be reviewed, that the case return to court, that it be a revocation of their probation, that the court take a look at what they have not done. Sometimes people will they'll do absolutely nothing, to be quite honest with you. Then there are others that once you sanction them, they'll get back in line. Now, it may take several times. Don't get me wrong. It may take several times before they get back on track. But then they'll eventually complete their probation successfully. One of the things that they have a very difficult time with, and I don't think this is a surprise to anyone, is meeting their financial obligations. This gets back to what Randy said, is that some of these fines are set by, fees are set statutorily, and there's nothing anyone can do about that. And to be quite honest with you, we will concentrate on the issue of getting them a job and making sure that they get the social service agency assistance that they need. The money is a secondary issue. No one is going back to court.
Correct me if I'm wrong,
Julia. No one is going back to court for not paying their money. No one is going back on revocation for not paying their court costs, or whatever the other fees that might be.
Unless there is restitution to a victim involved. But general fines and court fees, we do not revoke someone's probation based on non-payment.
And keep in mind, if a person is under court order for 12 months or 18 months, if they're doing the best they possibly can to meet those financial obligations, that's the best that they could do. And it may only be $10 a month. And I think that's one of the big reasons why some people don't make it through probation successfully. We have to close the case out unsuccessfully because they have not met their financial obligations. There's nothing else we can do about that. But we do understand that. There's just nothing we can do about it.
And we should add also that we have a collections agency that follows up with these cases when people owe fines and fees and court costs and that sort of thing. And they do their assessment of the individuals and determine whether the money is collectible or whether it's just simply not collectible. And if it's not collectible, then it's not collectible. But they proceed after probation is over.
And after a year or 18 months that we've worked with the individuals, we know whether or not it's willful intent. And I think that's the issue to be addressed. Is it willful intent to not pay? No, it's just an inability to pay. So if they're doing the best they can, that may be the best they could do. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Right. Recidivism.
What's the rate?
Everyone would like to know that. I don't really know what the rate might be. It would not be uncommon for us to have an individual who's on probation that's been on probation before. It would not be uncommon for us to have someone who's on probation that's previously been to the penitentiary. For instance, in our drug court, we might have somebody who's on probation, given the opportunity to participate in drug court, and they've previously been to the penitentiary three or four times. Well, I can only look at the cases that are closed unsuccessfully, but the figures would be skewed because a lot of them are closed unsuccessfully because they have not met their financial obligations. It may not be because they haven't met the other technical aspects of their probation. It's just that they may not have met those financial obligations. So I don't know what that number would be.
I think part of the problem with that, it seems like you ought to be able to say, well, X percentage. But part of the problem with that, I think anyone in the process would understand, would agree that it's how do you define recidivism? You know, and we've had hours and hours of conversations about what is reoffending. Is it getting arrested? Is it getting convicted? Is it getting a certain sentence? In what time period? And that's part of the problem why it's difficult, I think, to define it.
You can define recidivism, and we have done this for drug court, and I've actually been the one researching the drug court cases along with a number of interns over the last few years. And I think we're about at a point to publish something concerning recidivism on drug court, on the number of individuals that have graduated from drug court. And I think you're going to be surprised. I think those numbers are going to be pretty good. And keep in mind, our drug court consists of individuals unlike many other drug courts where it's first offenders, which typically the first offenders, they're going to make it on their own. Our drug court is structured for, if not for such a program, they would go to the penitentiary. And as I mentioned, many of them previously have been incarcerated. So we are looking at a number of statistics to include the length of time in drug court. And our review of the statistics goes out 5 years, which I think is remarkable. Typically, a year or two is what most programs would include in their statistical review. Our review will be 5 years out post-graduation of all the graduates from drug court since the beginning.
Whatever it is they may need, that it's actually available to them. Hard time getting the services they need, or is it, in your sense, it's motivation of the individual?
I think we're pretty fortunate in this community when compared to other communities. We do have an array of services that they can be called upon. We have excellent services. Some of the services have been here for years. Sometimes people don't have, you know, a bus pass. We'll provide them bus tokens. Sometimes they can't pay for the services. Getting back to the gentleman's remark concerning fees, we collect fees, probation services fees, that we sometimes use to cover those expenses. An example might be a sex offender that needs to have an assessment done. Well, they're supposed to pay for that. But you know what? We'd just soon see that assessment is done so the case can be processed as quickly as possible. And the treatment associated with it, which is very long. If they can't afford that, then we'll pay for that. But we also have to understand, too, that there is a thought here that they should have some buy-in, that they should pay something to the services that they're participating in. So they may pay $5 for a $20 service, and we might pick up the rest of it. But there'd have to be a proof, and the probation officer typically will put in a request to me to say, this person gets $650 a month from Social Security disability payments. He can't possibly pay the costs associated with the treatment. Would the department pick that up? And we'll pick that up. Number of them don't show up, even though they made the appointment. That if what you do instead of just making the appointment is contact the people prior to the appointment, make an effort to help them figure out how to get there, and remind them to be there, the numbers of people who make the appointments go way up. So what I'm wondering is if there's this kind of support services available in our probation department, or if it's just a matter of the first way of doing it. Well, I don't think it's because they don't know how to get there, and I don't think it's because they can't afford to get there. Sometimes, when speaking for juveniles, sometimes they don't have the support at home to make sure that the whole family goes where they're supposed to go. I think that's could be part of the reason. As far as the adults, I think there's a choice sometimes, and the choice is not to attend. Well, you would have the court costs and the fees. I think typically, like a DUI, the fees can be pretty high. I'm not sure exactly what those amounts of fees would be. Perhaps Julia would know that, but I mean it can run into several hundred dollars.
There are a number of statutorily required fees, depending on what the case is. For DUIs, there are mandatory minimum fines for all offenders. If you are in custody, you get credit for the time that you've spent in custody off of a number of mandatory fines and fees. So if you're sitting in jail because you haven't posted bond, you get, I think it's $6, $5 a day off of your fees as credit. But there are a number of fees that are required by the legislature. Every offense also has a range of fines that are available for us to come to an agreement on in plea negotiations or for a judge to impose. And when we're doing plea negotiations, we're going to look at somebody's financial circumstances when we're talking about discretionary fines. We're not going to require somebody to pay a fine if they don't have the money to do it. But certainly if they've got the money to do it, we might tack on a big fine and on top of everything else that we want them to do. But there, a lot of the fines are based on the particular offense. So for felony offenders, all convicted felons are required to provide a sample of their DNA to the state police. That's put into the system and kept for analysis for future offenses and that sort of thing. And there is a mandatory fee that goes along with that to process that DNA, and that's a required fee. If you have done it before, then we waive that because you don't need to keep giving up your DNA every time you get convicted of a felony. But there are a number of fines that are fees that are specific to the case. In drug cases, there are street value fines that are required, and those monies are dispersed to the arresting agency and the state police in various proportions, and it just depends on the nature of the case. And that's based on the value of the drugs that were collected during the arrest.
For me, there's a slight difference between fees and fines. I mean, if you like that term, to the is attached to the crime, but there's something about a court automation.
Well, there are a number of fees that Champaign County can impose under the statutes, and the county board decides what fees to impose and what the amount is, and those have a range as well. So court automation, and Deb Busey can help me with the details, what's the maximum court automation fund fee can be? So, that the county board can pick within the range how much they want. And we don't, none of our fees that are discretionary in that sense are at the maximum or even close.
Question of unsuccessfully closing your application, what does that answer mean?
Well, it means the case is closed without satisfying the conditions. It would, you know, they would look back and say, well, your case was closed. It looked like you did everything, but pay your money. I think it would be.
So we would see that in the record.
Yeah.
But we'd know what the reason for that would be, as opposed to somebody who was unsatisfactorily closed out because they didn't do their treatment that they were required, or they didn't attend the meetings they were required.
Or they might have been closed out because they were involved in another case and convicted. So, but generally, that it would mean just that, and it would be noted that they failed to pay their fees.
Okay. Any other questions for Joe?
Joe.
We have the capability to do electronic monitoring. We don't do a lot of electronic monitoring. We did at one time do some electronic monitoring associated with the domestic cases, violation of order of protection cases as a result of the Bischoff law. But it's not often a condition of probation. We do use electronic monitoring sometimes for the drug court cases. It's more of monitoring for alcohol use. The device also will detect the use of alcohol. That is correct. Right. Well, that would all be set by the court. So we wouldn't even, we just make a recommendation as to services available should the individual be sentenced to a community-based sentence. There's not a recommendation coming from court services, no. Right. Well, once we would review all the records, we would see what had happened, what transpired, and then we would try to pick those services up, link them up to the same agencies upon release. I would say it's not as well organized as would be, say, drug court. But drug court meets every week, and they have a team of participants, and that really does make a big difference. We obviously don't have that, nor do we, you know, could we possibly with the number of cases that we have. Would be borne by the offender should they not be able to pay for it. We work closely with the agencies to see that they are paid. We also have other contractors out in the community, whether it be individuals that do assessments for sex offenders. If the we don't want the individual to be not get paid. So we'll guarantee payment. If the offender doesn't pay, we will make sure that they pay, that is paid. Because we want them to be on point to provide the services, and to be quite honest with you, they want their money up front from the offender, and oftentimes they can't come up with $450 or whatever the cost may be. But we'll guarantee that payment, and if they don't pay, then we'll take care of it.
No.
That is correct. Well, I think it's typically in, associated with court services departments. I don't know how many pretrial programs there are in the state of Illinois. Typically with the larger counties, I'm sure you would see pretrial. Our county works a little differently because of the speed of individuals going to court. To have a pretrial the way it's presently set up, we'd have to have somebody on point. They're arrested tonight. You know, they'd have to go out to the jail early in the morning. They'd have to have access to records, which they would with our integrated justice system, to be able to provide information to the court that Randy is requesting. In other words, they'd have to meet with the offender and get that information and then try to verify that information very early in the morning that, yes, individual is working at Kraft or whatever. And then we would supply that information to the court.
Probably one person couldn't do that.
No, one person couldn't do that because arraignment court is every day, and you have to account for people being ill and vacations and other things. So it would take a number of people, I would assume.
If I in a typical morning, let's say, well, today, 16 people in custody, on top of everything else everybody had to do, I would say it's reasonable in my office for one attorney to be able to adequately review 3 cases well, and that depends on the significance of the particular case, to review the report, to look at the person's history, to make the decision, to do the paperwork, to get it processed through the system, all of that. So this morning when I had 16 people, I had to have at least half a dozen attorneys available at one time or another, including myself, to make all of that work. So I think it would be impossible for one person to do that for 16 people in a morning.
Any other questions? Mark.
I'm curious about the adult diversion or other programs you've had experience with in the past that
Are you asking me or him?
I guess that would actually be the leader of you. There was a reference to the victim under reconciliation.
Well, I think victim-offender reconciliation, they still use in the on the juvenile side in the regional planning department in their program, in their juvenile diversion program. What I've heard from them is that oftentimes it's difficult to get the victim, the actual crime victim, to get involved in the process. They don't necessarily want to sit across the table from somebody who offended against them and come to terms with that. They just want either to be done with the situation or that sort of thing. And so there are people who, in that program, who represent victims. So a merchant who might not have been the victim of a crime is willing to sit down across the table from a juvenile offender and explain how shoplifting affects merchants in general. But my understanding is that it's sometimes difficult to get the actual victim to be involved in that process. But that's always been a juvenile delinquency-based program, and I don't think has ever been done on the adult side. As far as adult diversion is concerned, currently we have a program that we're calling the Second Chance Program. I think Roger actually came up with that snappy title. You're welcome. But basically what that is for first offender adults who are being charged with felonies, if they are willing to be monitored, in a sense, before the case is resolved, and we come to an agreement with the defense attorney where they're going to do public service work, which is monitored by Joe's office, if there's restitution, pay restitution, or do an online education program, and we have found a wonderful online education program. The company is called Third Millennium, and they do online education programs across the country. They have 3 programs that we use. One is for marijuana use and possession. Another one is for underage drinking, and another one is for shoplifting. And it's a program where there's a start and a finish, and there's pre-test and post-test, and it goes through an entire education process, and there's checks and balances to make sure that you're not cheating and that you're actually finishing it. And the probation department gets a report from that agency. These people completed the test and the process, and there's a charge for that. It's $60, but they also are willing to make accommodations if there are financial issues and that sort of thing. So if the person completes those terms before in a designated time frame, then we will agree to reduce the charges from a felony to a misdemeanor. And then they pay court costs, and that's the end of the case, basically. So the opportunity is to go forth without a felony conviction on your record, but to also take responsibility and get some education in the process. And we've just started that. Scott actually is the attorney handling all of those cases. I don't know how many we have right now. Okay, so in the past month and a half, we've put 30 people into that process.
As far as the day reporting, there has been quite a bit of discussion about that over the years, and we did look into that. We actually went to several programs throughout the state. We went up to Cook County to look at their day evening reporting program. It is a financial issue. It would be a fair amount of money to implement that type of program. So we've never tried it here in Champaign County. I should also mention, too, that over the years, and this was mentioned, I think Lynn mentioned the intensive probation services. We no longer have intensive probation services. And that was a program specifically set aside for those individuals that, if not for such a program, they would go to the penitentiary. And we had a whole unit. And years ago, we even had a misdemeanor intensive unit. And both those units are gone just as a result of the various cutbacks we've had to make. You can see that we've gone to a point where we had some specialized services for domestic cases and the serious offenders, the intensive and so forth. And now we are really concentrating only on those individuals that are on probation that are pretty much all lumped together. Well, I've been here forever. I don't believe we've ever had a pretrial program. There has been some discussion about it, but we always felt like the way that the system worked presently and the way it's been refined to review cases and call these cases up in a short period of time, that there really wasn't a need for that.
Very few. I mean, first, okay, so the definition of a juvenile is if you commit a felony, it's 17 and older, you're an adult. If you commit a misdemeanor, it's 18 and older. So the 17-year-olds are kind of the question mark, because you could be an adult or a juvenile depending on what we call a particular case. So in general, we don't charge 17-year-olds as adult felons unless they're committing an adult felony. So, for example, if a 17-year-old goes to Schnucks and steals a candy bar and says, yeah, I walked into Schnucks intending to steal the candy bar, technically under the law, that's a burglary. If you enter a store with the intent to commit a theft, under Illinois law, that's a burglary. It's a felony. I could charge that 17-year-old with a Class 2 felony burglary, and we'd go forward. But I don't do that because it's also a misdemeanor theft and should be handled in juvenile court and actually much more appropriately through a diversion program. And so if you ask the police departments, they will tell you that they have a standing order from me that just because they're 17 and they commit a felony doesn't mean you arrest them as adults. More likely you see is there a misdemeanor and we deal with them in juvenile court. So that's one class, the 17-year-olds. Then juveniles, under the Juvenile Court Act, there are a number of scenarios where an actual juvenile, somebody who's under 17, could be charged as an adult. And those are very specific types of offenses: homicide, cases involving weapons, gang-related cases, very serious offenses. And also there are some offenses where based on somebody's prior juvenile history, we can charge them as an adult. So recently, for example, we have a young man who is currently on juvenile probation for residential burglary and car theft, in which he and another relative broke into somebody's house, stole their car, drove it up to Chicago, got in a chase with the Chicago cops on the highway, ran the car through one of the barriers on the interstate, all of that sort of thing. We put that kid on juvenile probation down here, and then he was involved in two other residential burglaries, broke into two other people's houses, stole things, all of that sort of thing. One time was armed with a gun. He's 16. We charged him as an adult because under the statute, you can charge a 16-year-old who's currently serving probation for a forcible felony as an adult if they commit further forcible felonies. But that requires the approval of the juvenile court judge, and so we had a hearing on that, and Judge Clem allowed him to be charged as an adult. But that's relatively rare, hopefully, certainly, given that sort of fact scenario. I would say probably under 10 cases a year. I would certainly hope it's under 10 cases a year. Again, you're talking about a young man who now, I believe, has broken into three people's houses. So I hope that's under 10 times a year.
As a follow-up, there are very few cases where it's a mandatory transfer to criminal court. As Julia mentioned, the 15, 16-year-olds that are involved in real serious crimes, there's very few of those.
Aggravated criminal sexual assault would be another one of those mandatory transfers to adult courts.
For those, for the motions to transfer, and we track those. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I would say it's very few. Probably in the last 5 years, it's been very few. I don't know exactly what that number would be, but certainly less than 10 a year.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions, Mark?
And just to follow up to those individuals, if they are like that young man, if he's held in custody, he's held at the detention center because of his age. He's required to continue to be held at the detention center, not in the adult jail. I think Veterans Court is the other specialty court that we don't have. And honestly, at this point, I don't know that we have the number of veterans involved in the criminal justice system to support a Veterans Court. And we do have a very good working relationship with Lori DeYoung at the VA. So when we have individuals who are veterans who need supportive services like mental health or substance abuse, we work, and I know Joe works, and the local police departments as well work directly with Lori to get them those services. Or we could have those people in mental health court or drug court. We talked about that in mental health court in a couple of cases, but again, because the VA has those services available, oftentimes it's better for the individual to just concentrate on getting those services through the VA and trying to resolve their cases that way. So, for example, I can think of one situation where someone had felony DUI, and he was a veteran, and rather than getting him involved in mental health court, he concentrated on utilizing the services of Veterans Court or of the VA and the services he could get there, and we continued his case, and then when Lori told us he had successfully completed, then we dismissed the case.
We do a lot of referrals to the various programs for partner abuse. This would be for the domestic cases. Certainly Prairie Center and Community Elements are our two big ones. On those two issues, it seems to me like over the years that Community Elements and Prairie Center, they've had to cut back also. They don't have the services or the number of personnel that they have had in the past, and that means that sometimes we might have to look elsewhere, sometimes out of the community, potentially for services, if that includes residential care?
I think there are a number of faith-based organizations that we rely on in the criminal justice system as well, especially for some residential-type programs that are faith-based and but also work very closely with the court system. Those are very important and significant. And the Regional Planning Commission, I think, is another county agency that provides a lot of services, particularly to the indigent. And I had, last time I was here, had brought up the employment and job training type programs. And I had gotten some information about some programs that they have in Peoria and passed that on to a couple of you and to some people in regional planning and also to Peter Tracy. And I've since learned that regional planning is taking on the jobs training and employment programs, and Darlene Kleppel over there is going to be in charge of that, and Deb might have a little more information about that. But I think that is a source of programming options and also an agency that seeks out funding for other programming options. Darlene also applied for a grant for a youth drug court as well that we're waiting to hear on. And today in interoffice mail, she sent me a brochure about a horticulture program at a jail in Utah that she found that she thought was interesting and wanted me to pass on to you all. So this is one of these programs where they grow vegetables and that sort of thing at the jail and then sell them at local farmers markets. And I think we've discussed that in the past as well and have done that on the juvenile side with in a number of different ways, with the Boys and Girls Club specifically. So
one other thing when we're talking about agencies, we do we're required by the administrative office to look at agencies or programs that are classified as evidence-based programs, programs that work. We do work closely with Cognition Works as an agency in Urbana, just basically down the street from the courthouse, and they operate cognitive think skill building classes for the drug court offenders, and we are also contracting with them to run a program specifically for the some adult probationers. We have yet to get that off the ground, but we would anticipate probably in, you know, within a month we'll actually have those classes up and going, up and running. Cognition Works.
Okay. Do we have any more questions for State's Attorney or for Court Services? Julie.
Mm-hmm. Safe House. What is that? Which particular church? I'm not. Restoration Urban Ministries, which is out there on Mattis, Safe House. No, you can't make a direct referral to them, but although in drug court, they are part of the process.
Right. It could be part of the process associated with the drug court.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Thanks for coming in and giving us some of your time tonight, guys.
Happy to be here.
Okay, and so the next thing we have on the agenda is the discussion of the next steps, which I don't think the overall timeline has changed too much since last month. Like we were saying in public participation, the county board is not going to be looking at the applications for RFPs until next month at the earliest. Might go later, but certainly no earlier. And so October is probably going to be the earliest time that there's a contractor who's actually on the ground who would be working with anybody here, which is why there has been discussion of reappointing this task force with the new board starting in December. That's not a motion; it hasn't been passed, but that's been thrown out there. It might be October, November before this needs assessment on the county's facilities and its needs is starting, and so it's pretty unlikely that that's really going to be getting started before this term. So we pretty much talked about that. I think we've talked about this before, and everybody here has said they would be willing to be reappointed. Is that, if that's the direction the county board were going, is that still standing? And then, so you guys may have to be reappointed to work with the contractor for the needs assessment going forward on that, because that may be stretching into next year, and that may get pushed back even further. There is some discussion of possibly not having the money in this, not having this start until the next fiscal year, which would be December. So it's hard to say at this point when that would be getting going.
Chairman,
yes.
If we were to get reappointed, I'd like to suggest some strategies that we think about that would differ. We have one more person appointed to this room. More than two of us could have a chat at the same moment and not be invited. Or,
well, it's very possible that if they do that, they make changes like that. Well, if you're talking about us needing to have different procedures because this is a duly constituted public body and the facilities task force not being one, then that's not going to be something you can get around because it's Illinois law. Now, obviously, if you have more people can talk because you're not violating the Open Meetings Act, but that is why we're looking at these things, and the other task force is not hampered by that. That's right. We could.
Thank you. on quite a few beers in my house tonight. That, go ahead, Lynn.
Well, I'm not I just want to comment, but I think it's important to do this. The inefficiency point has come out, I think, important because of this. I can't fathom that there's, you know, seems to be a committed to full transparency and accountability.
Well, and the other discussion on next step is I believe we're still sitting in the same place for next month's meeting that we were last month, that the schedule calls for, and we're talking about basically discussing these community agencies, these social services that are being utilized and could be utilized. We touched on that a little bit tonight with the state's attorney, and court services talking about some of the things. Some of the agencies that they're already using. Is there anything else that anybody thinks needs to be on the agenda or thinks that needs to be tweaked or anything like that for next month's agenda? James? I think that's fair, and I think that's probably something we should talk about so we know where we want to go as we're going into October and November. And there's a lot of ways that this body can decide to shape that. We have questions like, are we going to do a minority report? You basically are eight people with eight different expertises. It's how much is this going to be integrated? How much is this going to be a group report? Do we want a minority report? These are all questions that we should probably have a discussion on so we know what we want to do going forward. And the best way to get what you guys have learned and what your guys are already bringing to the table, the best way to get that out there. So I think that's a great idea. Scott, you had something?
Only that the timing of it, if we did this coming, would be good because if you're talking about going to the board or giving the board what we want to do around the October meeting or even September meeting, in terms of reappointment or planning in terms of that, we're going to have that.
and Pius has also made it clear that the mandate calls for meetings through October, but there's no reason not to stretch the report creating process into November. The board term ends the end of November, and so he seems to be fine with that. Yeah, the next, well, the basically any reappointment would be by the new board in December, but it's definitely something for the board to talk about before how they want to go forward. And part of this is going to be contingent on what the board is deciding to do with the RFP and what the timeline is going to end up with that. Am I fairly correct on what the timeline is right now, Deb? That there you go. And that's really because the other main thing besides this report that the county board wanted you guys to do was to work with that needs assessment. And if that's not happening until after this is supposed to be done, then obviously that's a problem for the original charter. Are there any other things that we need to talk about next month or need to bring up now for moving this process forward?
Yeah.
Ms. Busey, am I seeing your pointing right, that a great resource for us is Court Services has a pretty good handle on what's been working and not working to an extent anyway, Champaign County? Roger.
Right.
Well, and one thing to keep in mind for next month, now that you guys are bringing up Mark, is when we're talking, when we're going to be talking about community programs, community agencies, a lot of the members of this task force can speak to that. So be thinking, I know specifically Mark, Benita, James, Sheila's not here, but we want to hear a lot about a lot of your local experiences on things like that. That's really going to come to bear next month. It's going to be your time to talk about what you're doing and what challenges are out there that could be changed to make things work better. Some of that expertise and knowledge is hopefully in this room already. Anything else we want to talk about? Next steps for tonight, next month, going forward? Yeah, that would be great. We have a month. I think we had a pretty successful exchange that did not violate the Open Meetings Act. These last few days, we can definitely do that again. And probably what the county board does is generally bounce things through the administrators. One of the easiest ways to maybe get around a little bit of the frustration with the limitations the county board has been putting on you is to have these email chains, basically with me me moderating and BCCing these things and bouncing things back out, or having something that the administration is sending out to everybody. So there are ways we can do things like that, and we can keep this discussion going on what we want to do next month. going in these next few days, like we did with what questions we want and what just had the discussion we had on what we wanted for the agenda for this month. We can definitely do that, and if anybody can think of ways to improve that, we can do that as well. But we can talk about that. Is that the budget hearing? Yeah. But possibly, the 27th of August doesn't work. The 30th might. I assume the Tuesday of that first week is county board meeting. So the 5th? Is that acceptable to everybody? People want to do the 10th or possibly try Thursday the 30th? Can't do the 30th. Okay. Well, can't be the 4th. Well, if we have an alternate date, we may not be able to have all 9 people, just like tonight. Sheila was unable to make it. We didn't change the meeting. So we should pick whatever the most people should be able to make if we're going to not be able to do it the 3rd, which is a holiday. So okay. Do you guys want to do the 20th? So a week. We had said the 27th, so 2 weeks before. Mark. Well, but I don't. Is that what everybody wants to do? Am I hearing the objections? 10th and 24th, is that good for everybody? Of September? And then regular meeting in October? Okay. September 10th and 24th will be our September meetings. Then regularly scheduled time in October. We kind of skipped over other business straight to the next meeting date, but is there any other business? Okay, we are adjourned.